Imagine a wildfire, so immense, like the heat blasts upward with such violence that it literally creates its own hurricane.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
Right. You've got dry lightning raining down miles away, hurricane force winds spreading embers in every direction, and firestorms that basically just feed themselves. That is what is happening across Europe this morning. Welcome to frontpage.world. It's Tuesday, July 28, 2026.
And as you join us for your daily international morning briefing, the continent is essentially acting as this massive climate crucible.
Completely rewriting the rules of how natural disasters even operate.
Yeah, the scale of what is blanketing the front pages of Le Monde, El Pais, and the Frankfurter Allgemeine Zeitung is just, I mean, it's staggering. We're at a point where these are no longer being classified as wildfires.
They're megafires.
Exactly, megafires. We are looking at a fundamental shift in the physical mechanics of the environment.
The numbers coming out of the French and Spanish papers are honestly terrifying. Like, Le Monde is reporting that in France's Gironde region, right near Bordeaux, 42,000 hectares have already burned to the ground.
Good grief.
And that has forced the evacuation of 220,000 people.
Yeah.
Then you look over at Spain, where El País reports that across Avila, Madrid, and Castellón, another 77,000 hectares are destroyed.
And Spanish firefighters are currently, you know, racing the clock because a fourth heat wave is looming right around the corner.
It's relentless. And the Financial Times is really highlighting why this is so difficult to contain. They're detailing that phenomenon you just mentioned, these megafires creating their own weather systems.
Right. It's a meteorological event called a pyrocumulonimbus cloud.
Oh, what?
Pyrocumulonimbus. Basically, when a fire burns hot enough, it pushes air up into the atmosphere so fast that it forms a massive thunderstorm entirely made out of smoke and heat.
That is terrifying.
It really is. These clouds generate erratic winds and dry lightning, which strikes the ground like miles ahead of the main blaze and sparks fresh fires.
So it's spreading itself.
Exactly. European firefighters are trained for traditional forest fires, they're completely unaccustomed to battling self-replicating firestorms.
Okay, let's unpack this, because you're describing a self-sustaining monster that doesn't care about national borders or jurisdictions. And the irony jumping off the front pages today is just glaring.
Oh, absolutely.
While these fires are literally erasing the physical landscape, the political bickering over climate change is completely stalled. I mean, we're seeing actual military helicopters. The Frankfurter Allgemeine Zeitung notes the German Bundeswehr is sending heavy lift CH-53s and an A-400M transport plane flying across national lines into France just to dump water on these flames.
Yeah, they're physically stepping in.
Right, but politically, they are worlds apart.
What's fascinating here is the stark contrast between that physical reality and the political reality. On the ground, you have this highly unified cross-border European response where German military assets are saving French homes.
Yeah.
But in the halls of power, the fragmentation is really deep. El País notes that Spanish Prime Minister Pedro Sanchez is pleading for a state pact on the climate emergency to build up national resilience.
How did that go over?
Well, the opposition party, the PP, specifically Esther Muñoz, dismissed the proposal entirely. She called it an ideological mantra and literally stated that the climate has always changed.
Wow. It feels like the physical reality of climate change is entirely outpacing Europe's legislative consensus. You know, you have flames creating their own weather systems, and politicians are debating if the flames are political.
Right.
But why does that matter for the average person watching this unfold?
Because a failure to reach legislative consensus basically means a failure to fund long-term structural resilience. I mean, if a nation cannot agree on the root cause of a crisis, it can't build the infrastructure required to survive the consequence.
That makes sense.
You need massive capital to redesign cities for extreme heat or to overhaul emergency response networks for megafires. Instead, they're trying to fight tomorrow's environmental disasters using yesterday's political gridlock.
And that failure to protect critical infrastructure in Europe perfectly mirrors what we are reading on the front pages of the Middle East this morning. Because if Europe's vulnerability is weather, the global economy's vulnerability is energy choke points.
Oh, completely. The strategic arteries of the global economy are under immense pressure right now, and the tension is highly localized.
Reading through the Wall Street Journal and the Japan Times, the biggest headline is actually about a pause, surprisingly. The U.S. has paused its military strikes against Iran for a second night.
A very fragile pause.
Yeah. And this lull has allowed for frantic diplomatic talks regarding the safety of the Strait of Hormuz. Now, I know Oman is brokering this, but how exactly does that work behind the scenes?
So Oman functions essentially as the Switzerland of the Middle East. They maintain this quiet, backdoor diplomatic channel where U.S. and Iranian officials can pass messages indirectly without ever sitting in the same room.
Oh.
And the goal of this specific channel right now is entirely focused on the Strait of Hormuz, which is the most critical artery for global energy. A massive percentage of the world's oil flows through that narrow waterway.
Right.
Any military miscalculation there could choke the global energy supply literally overnight.
It's like pressing down on a waterbed, you know? You apply pressure to secure the Strait of Hormuz, you get a breather there, and the water just rushes to the other end, bulging out in Yemen.
That is a perfect way to describe it.
The New York Times is reporting that the proxy war in Yemen is escalating again. The Bab al-Mandab Strait is flaring up. The Houthis have launched a fresh wave of drone strikes aimed straight at Saudi Aramco facilities.
Yeah, it's heating up fast.
But I'm struggling to understand the Houthi motivation here. If Saudi Arabia desperately wants to pull out of this war to focus on its economy, why provoke them into staying?
You have to look at the leverage each player holds. Saudi Arabia wants to pivot its economy to become a global business and tourism hub, right? A protracted war in Yemen completely derails the economic vision. The Houthis know this. The Houthis want territorial control and leverage over oil resources. So by striking Aramco facilities now, just as the U.S. and Iran take a breath, they are signaling that they can hold Saudi Arabia's economic future hostage until their territorial demands are met.
They
feel they have nothing to lose in a stalemate, but the Saudis have everything to lose.
So the Houthis are maximizing their leverage while everyone else is distracted. But then you zoom out to the global actors. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu is heading to Washington right now.
Yes, his eighth meeting with U.S. President Donald Trump.
Exactly. And it is explicitly designed to push the agenda on Iran ahead of both nations' upcoming elections. Why is he making that trip right now? Like, how does that benefit his domestic optics?
For both leaders, projecting strength against a foreign adversary is a proven electoral strategy. Netanyahu wants to demonstrate to his domestic base that he is the only leader capable of securing U.S. backing against the overarching Iranian threat. It's essentially a theater of strength.
And the global markets are hanging on every single word of this theater. Look at the financial pages today. That single night of peace, the U.S. pausing strikes on Iran, caused a 5% plunge in global oil prices.
Yeah, and that drop is a perfect example of how financial mechanisms operate today. It wasn't, you know, human traders sitting in a pit making calculations.
Nah.
No, it was algorithmic trading. Bots scrape news headlines for words like pause or diplomacy, and they execute massive sell-offs on oil futures contracts in milliseconds.
Wow.
The global economy is so highly leveraged on the stability of the Middle East that a single 24-hour pause in strikes translates into an instantaneous economic panic, swinging valuations by billions of dollars.
It's just wild. And, you know, if energy is the geopolitical leverage of today, silicon is the leverage of tomorrow. So let's pivot to the tech war, because the front pages in Asia and the Americas are painting a crazy picture of the new global economy.
The semiconductor industry is undeniably the new battleground for global supremacy.
So if you're wondering why you should care about a memory chip company in Shanghai, consider that this directly dictates who controls the AI that will run everything from your car to your bank in the very near future.
Exactly.
A Chinese memory chip maker called CXMT just made its stock market debut in Shanghai. And the numbers are ridiculous. The stock surged 466%. They raised $8.5 billion. And it briefly surpassed Tencent to become mainland China's most valuable company.
Incredible numbers.
But what's really striking is the completely fractured reality depending on which paper you read today.
The framing definitely reveals the anxieties of each nation.
The Wall Street Journal and the Financial Times frame this as pure AI fever. They're treating CXMT as an existential threat to U.S. and South Korean chipmakers. And they specifically point out that CXMT is pulling this off despite intense U.S. export controls, specifically the bans on accessing ASML manufacturing tools.
Which is a huge detail.
Right, let's clarify that for a second. They are pulling this off without ASML tools. Which is insane because ASML basically holds a global monopoly on the complex, extreme, ultraviolet lithography machines needed to physically print advanced chips.
Which is exactly why the Western papers are so alarmed. Memory chips, specifically DRAM chips, which is what CXMT makes, are foundational for AI.
Because AI needs memory.
Exactly. Artificial intelligence isn't just about processing power. It requires massive amounts of short-term memory to hold and process data sets simultaneously. If China is manufacturing high-level DRAM without Western machinery, the embargo has, well, it's failed.
But wait, let's look at the actual mechanism of these sanctions. Is this actual self-reliance, or is the China Daily just spinning state-sponsored propaganda to mask how much the U.S. sanctions are hurting?
That's the million-dollar question.
Because China Daily frames this as a massive triumph of domestic innovation. They cite resilient industrial growth, noting industrial profits are up 18.7%. I mean, did the U.S. sanctions actually end up helping China? It feels like a parent taking away a kid's calculator to punish them, only for the kid to go to their room and invent a supercomputer from scratch.
If we connect this to the bigger picture, you are hitting on the core fear of Western policymakers. Sanctions are designed to choke an industry by starving it of necessary tools.
Right.
But by completely cutting China off, they forced Beijing's hand. China realized they could not rely on the West for their future economy, so they poured unimaginable state resources into building a sanction-proof, fully autonomous AI supply chain.
Wow.
Whether it is entirely self-reliant today or heavily subsidized by the state to appear that way, the trajectory is clear. They are building a parallel tech ecosystem.
And they are building a parallel economic system to go with it. China Daily also reports a major phone call between Chinese President Xi Jinping and Brazil's President Lula da Silva.
Yeah, that call is significant.
Xi is pushing hard for a China-Mercosul deal. For anyone unfamiliar, Mercosul is the major South American trade bloc, and Xi is specifically calling for global South solidarity against external tariffs.
It is a very strategic, quiet, long game. China is wooing the global South, building massive economic alliances based on trade, infrastructure, and now technology.
Yeah.
But look at what is occupying the bandwidth on the other side of that equation.
Well, yeah. While Xi is trying to talk trade, Lula is highly distracted. The front pages of Brazil's Folha de São Paulo and Spain's El País are dominated by a massive diplomatic crisis in South America.
It's a mess.
Argentina's President Javier Milei visited Brazil not to see Lula, but to support a political rival, Flavio Bolsonaro. And while there, Milei publicly called Lula socialist trash, a thief, and a convict. Brazil immediately summoned its ambassador. It's a full-blown crisis over name-calling.
The duality of global power today is playing out in real time. On one track, you have China methodically building autonomous tech supply chains and negotiating massive trade blocs. On the other track, you have major democratic leaders bogged down in volatile, social media-fueled ideological mudslinging. When leaders are trading personal insults on foreign soil, they aren't negotiating trade deals, they aren't securing supply chains. The geopolitical friction is completely consuming their bandwidth.
Here's where it gets really interesting, though. Because that friction isn't just international. We are seeing major democracies across the globe wrestling with their own specific flavors of internal collapse.
Yes, the domestic issues are just as intense.
If you read the Frankfurter Allgemein and the Sydney Morning Herald side by side today, you see a terrifying theme of state apparatus failure. Let's look at Germany first. The FAZ reports a horrific terror attack at a Berlin Pride march.
Yeah, an awful tragedy.
An ISIS sympathizer named Abdul Balout drove a car into the crowd, leaving one dead and 29 injured. And Chancellor Friedrich Merz is facing intense political pressure because the attacker was known to authorities and was actually on probation.
It is a profound failure of the security apparatus to monitor a known threat. When the state fails to protect its citizens from someone who is already in the system, public trust shatters.
And you see a different kind of failure in Australia. The Sydney Morning Herald has uncovered this explosive bare-knuckle corruption inquiry. Liberal Party operatives allegedly took a $2 million bribe from a fugitive developer named Jean Nassif.
$2
million? Yeah. And the goal of the bribe? To get a government building commissioner sacked simply because he was looking too closely at the developer's projects. It is purely transactional.
So in Germany and Australia, you have state failure and corruption. But then you look at the front pages in South Korea and India, and you see almost the opposite: reaction, populist pushback, and the weaponization of justice.
Exactly. In South Korea, the Joongang Ilbo reports that former President Yoon Suk-yeol was just sentenced to a year and a half in prison, suspended for 3 years, for election law violations dating back to his 2022 campaign. So the moment you leave office, your political rivals are waiting with a pair of handcuffs.
The threshold for prosecuting former leaders is lowering globally. It treats the justice system not as an impartial arbiter, but as an extension of political warfare.
And in India, the Times of India reports that the Cockroach Janta Party is threatening to resume massive street protests. They claim the government breached an agreement to drop police reports against their protesters.
Right.
Meanwhile, the Delhi police are pushing back, claiming that 101 people accused of murder were actually part of a violent march on Parliament.
Step back and look at the underlying mechanism in all four of these stories. State apparatuses are struggling to maintain authority and public trust simultaneously.
Yeah.
Democracies require the consent of the governed, and that consent relies entirely on the belief that the system is fair, capable, and protective. When that belief wavers, whether through a failure to stop a known terrorist, accepting millions in bribes, jailing former presidents, or battling citizens in the streets, the institutional stress test becomes critical.
Which brings us to a really fascinating question. What does this mean for you? When the macro world, the climate, the global supply chains, the democratic institutions feels this chaotic and untrustworthy, how are everyday people responding?
They retreat. When massive systems feel entirely out of our hands, human psychology dictates that we try to heavily control our microsystems.
And the social shifts we are seeing reported today reflect that perfectly. In Japan, the Japan Times says the government is drastically tightening permanent residency rules.
Right, the new benchmarks.
Yeah, they're implementing strict income, language, and pension benchmarks, specifically to prevent immigrants from relying on welfare. The state is demanding quantifiable, heavily documented proof of value.
The demand for data and quantifiable metrics is an attempt to create certainty in an uncertain environment.
And that demand for data is bleeding into everyday life. In Australia, the Sydney Morning Herald is warning about a disturbing trend in schools. They're seeing a spike in AI-generated deepfakes.
This one is particularly alarming.
It is. Pictures of children and teachers are being scraped from official school social media feeds and manipulated into explicit or compromising synthetic imagery. The boundary of what is real and what is synthetic is literally collapsing for everyday families.
It creates an intense, visceral feeling of vulnerability. If you can't trust what you see in your own local school district, the world feels inherently unsafe.
But then you look at the Wall Street Journal, and they highlight this lighter but honestly fascinating trend in the U.S. Young adults are facing what they call a baby bust, and they are responding by becoming love hackers.
Love hackers.
Yes, they're using spreadsheet apps, as one literally called Spread, to grade their dates.
Oh, my.
They are inputting data points, ranking core values, and crowdsourcing feedback from their friends to determine compatibility. It's like they're running a personal IPO. We were just talking about the CXMT chipmaker raising billions on the stock market. These people are treating human romance like a corporate merger that requires a quarterly earnings report before you commit to a second date.
This raises an important question, though. Why are we seeing this impulse to spreadsheet romance?
Right.
As you just mapped out, the macro world feels incredibly out of control. Mega fires are creating their own weather systems. Deepfakes are infiltrating elementary schools. Global energy markets are hinging on a 24-hour pause in drone strikes. Individuals feel entirely powerless.
So they focus on what they can measure.
Exactly. So they retreat into micromanagement. They try to quantify and control the one thing they feel they still have agency over, their personal lives and their relationships. If you can't control the climate, maybe you can control your dating algorithm.
It's the ultimate illusion of control in a chaotic world. Well, that wraps up today's global overview. Thank you for joining us for this deep dive into frontpage.world.
I will leave you with this final thought to consider as you go about your day. We are living in an era entirely obsessed with prediction and control. We use AI to model climate megafires. We build highly autonomous, heavily subsidized tech supply chains to avoid geopolitical sanctions. And we even track our dating compatibility on spreadsheets. We want everything mapped out, quantified, and secured.
We really do.
Yet look at the most disruptive forces we discussed today. A lone wolf attacker in Berlin. A sudden, visceral insult traded between two presidents on foreign soil. A spontaneous protest movement erupting in the streets of India.
None of that was planned.
Right. These events aren't algorithmic. They are entirely driven by raw, unquantifiable human emotion. So as our systems become increasingly data-driven, rigid, and automated, does human nature itself become the ultimate, unsolvable vulnerability in the machine?
Definitely something to think about as you watch the smoke clear. We will be back tomorrow to look at the front pages again and bring you your international morning briefing. Until then, Take care.